Thanks for joining us, and welcome to the Reptile Living Room, featuring John Taylor of Herp House Magazine and James Tintle with Cold Blooded Publishing. The Reptile Living Room is brought to you by Herp House Magazine, the premier digital magazine for the reptile hobbyist, and by Cold Blooded Publishing, your exclusive reptile media publishing company. Now, here are John and James in the Reptile Living Room.
Good evening and welcome to another broadcast of the Reptile Living Room. We're the only independently produced and distributed live reptile broadcast available today. Each week we bring you a specific panel of herpeticulture and herpetological respondents to discuss the various aspects of our community and current events impacting and affecting herpeticulture and herpetology. Reptile Living Room also brings modern day technology to our community through our interactive platform, interact with our hosts, guests, and other like-minded individuals on the Reptile Living Room YouTube channel live during the show. Man, completely blew this intro, Jimmy. I'm your host on the Taylor Reptile Apartment Group, and would like to introduce my co-host, James Snow of Tremendous Tricolors. Hello, James, as well as introducing the always forgotten executive producer, Mr. Chad Burns, with no cheesecake people. Last week you had caramel cheesecake, is what I remember. Bastard.
Wow, what an intro, John.
Hey, you know.
quite the intro for this Thursday. I guess it's par for the course for the week, for the month.
This month, man, it's been rough. It's been really just, it's been a nightmare of inconsistencies and things we didn't need to happen. But yeah. Tonight's different. Tonight we're talking about sociability and snakes and reptile intelligence and cognition, and everything is okay with the world. So let's run through our sponsors.
we have sponsors to go through. Let's go ahead and make the announcement here. For anybody watching, let's go ahead and make the announcement that Reptile Living Room will be moving to a new day as of the end of September, beginning of October. We'll have all the information out, but we're going to move to a new day. We're going to move to Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. So before I get into that, just want to let everybody know that it'll be Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. Due to scheduling issues of guests, it just makes it so much easier on Tuesdays versus Thursdays. We all know football season's around, so everybody wants to sit at home and eat popcorn and drink beer on Thursdays watching a football game. So,
what is football?
Oh, that's where the wife beaters and child beaters actually get on a field with some helmets and try to beat each other up.
Oh, so it's actually taking up male aggression.
You need a reason to sit around and drink beer and eat pizza and stuff?
Well, not really, but, you know.
I was going to say.
Well, it could be just Reptile Living Room. That could be a good enough reason, it's true. Right?
It's true. Reptile always a good excuse to sit around and eat popcorn and drink beer.
I do it every week.
Oh, boy.
No problem.
All right. All right, enough with the funny stuff on Reptile Living Room this week. Let's go right into our sponsors. First sponsor of the night is going to be Blue Maestro with their Tempo unit. Digital thermometer. You don't need to be sitting there. You can actually check it right on your cell phone. All the information comes to your cell phone. So go ahead. And it's a temperature, barometric pressure, and humidity device. So it records all of that for you and sends it right to your cell phone. So that's the Tempo by Blue Maestro. We'll go into a Canadian reptile supplier.
Yeah.
The Dragon Lair. Check them out. If you're watching us on Google+, you can check the right-hand side. I have all the links on the right-hand side there. The Dragon Lair. Now for your reptile shipping, reptilesexpress.com. Contact Debbie over at reptilesexpress.com and tell her Reptile Living Room sent you. They have great rates on shipping. You can get boxes, heat packs, cold packs, all that stuff. You can order it all from reptilesexpress.com. Now we'll go into somebody that's done some great artwork, Natalyn Bieto. So it's reptilearts.com. She does stickers, commission artwork. Check her out. She's done some really cool stuff lately. Another artist we have as a sponsor is Rachel Winchin of Happy Gecko Sticky Situation. I guess she is extremely busy this time of year getting ready for Tinley. Friends with her on Facebook, and she just says her printer's going nonstop between now and Tinley Park. Is that what you've seen too, John?
Dude, between now and Tinley Park, my wife and I were just joking about that with my mother-in-law. We're like, wow. Rachel is like, she just sets paper in the printer and just lets it go until she wakes up in the morning. And then when she wakes up in the morning, she just sets more paper in there and just lets it go.
Yeah.
It's literally continually just nonstop. I think Becky figured it out. She has 2 weeks of printer to go before she actually reaches goal to finish for Tinley Park alone.
She's going to need a forklift with those big paper wheels. Bring it right up into the front door and just hook it on the thing and just let it go.
Exactly.
Rachel, that's great news. We're very, very happy for you. We're only making fun. No big issues there. I know you're watching. So let's go to one of our final sponsors tonight. It's going to be reptileapartment.com. That website is owned by the one and only John Taylor, our co-host over there. Check out reptileapartment.com. We got all kinds of stuff coming up in the near future for reptileapartment.com. John, you want to give them a quick overview of what reptileapartment.com is all about?
Oh, my gosh. Captive care, scientific articles that you might not receive somewhere else as far as the reptile blogosphere or reptile websites are concerned. James does a great job reviewing all the scientific articles and actually not necessarily translating them into English, but he puts them into context where most regular readers can understand versus James talking about chromatophores and rhetophores and all of the weird scientific stuff. He just basically throws it out in English so we can all understand it, what he's talking about. So there's lots of scientific articles, lots of captive care stuff. We actually have some new guest bloggers coming on board. Christina Miller has just started with her, essentially it's another Ask the Vet column, similar to Herp House Digital Magazine, but it's actually for free right there on Reptile Apartment. She started off with metabolic bone disease, which of course is a concern to all lizard owners as well as reptile owners. So definitely, yeah, check us out, reptileapartment.com.
Sweet. Yeah, I'm pretty excited with some of the guest bloggers we have lined up going into the new year, the end of this year, new year. Should have some really interesting stories on reptileapartment.com.
Yeah, to say the least.
And just so everybody knows, it's kind of part of the Reptile Apartment group, Reptile Living Room, reptileapartment.com, reptileapartment.canada.ca, and Herp House Mag, kind of all into one, so... But, and then, of course, that is it, unless you want to check out Cold Blooded Publishing on Facebook, and if I would ever get off my lazy butt and get the website up and going, I could send you there, but unfortunately, I am tied up with all kinds of other work going on.
Yeah, something like catching out, you know, really cool snakes and selling them to collectors over in Japan.
Yeah, you know how it is.
Yeah, the rough life.
Cleaning poop all day.
Yeah, clean snake poop. That's what we do.
So, Chad, you got anything on the agenda for this week? Anything cool come across your feed this week? Or are you just kind of sitting back enjoying yourself this show?
Yeah, I'm just kind of chilling this one.
Oh, man. Whatever.
I've got a lot of things in the works. So I'm reading some articles right now as we're speaking, and I got some big things coming up for us. So,
all right. You're reading articles and working on the show all at once.
Multitasking.
That's awesome.
Great. All right. So this... What's that, Chad?
You get every dime worth out of me, man.
Paychecks in the mail, man. Paychecks in the mail.
Checks in the mail, exactly. All
right. All right, so, John, what do we got for this week's show? It's
This week, definitely one of my favorite shows. Get to talk about snake and reptile cognition, family values, just everything about Crotalus that you could ever want to talk about. Melissa is going to cover that, or at least I'd probably say 99% of it. I've had the courtesy of interviewing Melissa before when she was first starting the research. Well, I wouldn't say first starting. Probably a little while into the research is when I finally caught up with her. She's doing some incredible research on the behavioral aspects of one of my favorite species, the Crotalus or rattlesnake species, as they are known to most of our generalized public. She's been doing a number of years researching rattlesnakes and their behavior, as well as the family structure, and just a lot of different aspects. Everything she and the Advocates for Snake Preservation stand for are the exact same values that Rise Against Rattlesnake Roundups, yourself, myself, and Chad stand for. Don't kill snakes. Educate people about them. So therefore, they'll know and have a better knowledge when they encounter them again. Hey, this is a cool species. It doesn't, you know, it's not out to get me. It's not out to kill me. But we'll get into all that with Melissa's interview and find out some of the family structures and some of the cognition that actually goes into rattlesnake research. So, with that, we'll introduce Melissa Amarillo from the Advocates of Advocates for Snake Preservation.
Boy, are you tongue-tied tonight, man.
I'm telling you. You're horrible.
Professor hiding in your shirt must have got your tongue.
So, Melissa, welcome to the show once again. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So, last time we talked, you were just finishing up the research on the different aspects of the various rattlesnake families that you had found out at Mule Shoe Ranch, I believe.
Yeah, we're kind of finished up at Mule Shoe, and so we're actually like going back to do more work at the site where I did the work for my master's degree, which is in central Arizona. It's on public land, it's not on a private nature preserve, so we have to be a little more hush-hush about where exactly it is, as you know. But yeah, it's following up on sort of trying to get some data to add to some long-term information on sociality and getting into some genetic stuff that we weren't, you know, you don't really have time to get into that stuff with a master's because it's two or three years is all you get.
Yeah, that limited time frame, that kills you. That's understandable. So talk to us about what your research has so far discovered. As far as much as you can tell us anyway without going into, you know, the protected secrets that, you know, you're going to defend your thesis work and stuff.
You know, really, the only information that's protected is the location. The rest of it, I'm pretty open with. I think we'll get it published soon enough where no one's going to see us because it takes so much work to get to this point. I'm not worried about it. Yep. Basically, what we set out to do, well, let me step back a little further. So I started off my graduate program wanting to look at color change in Arizona black rattlesnakes because that's another cool thing they do is they can change color like a chameleon, not quite that fast, but that dramatically from a light gray to a jet black, within a few minutes to an hour. And so I was trying to figure out that. And so a friend of mine said, hey, I know someplace you can go in the spring and you'll just see piles of them. So it's a really good opportunity to get a big sample size. You can look at a lot of different snakes. And once we went to this place and saw these piles of snakes, kind of lost interest in the whole color thing and figure out what this was all about. You know, you can imagine groups of denning snakes is not, that's not a new phenomenon. That's certainly not a discovery on our part. I mean, people have known that snakes have done that and taken advantage of that for bad things, which we can get into later, for since we've known, you know, that snakes exist. When we think about big communal dens, though, you usually think about places like Canada or, you know, the northern part of the western United States, where it's just so cold that there's very few places where animals can get underground and get below the frost line and where they're not going to die over the winter. Well, I work in Arizona. We don't have any place like that. I mean, there's abundant habitat for snakes to den seemingly pretty much everywhere. And with Arizona black rattlesnakes, you have places within their range where they den by themselves and den in groups at the same spot. So there's something else going on, or that was our thought, that there might be something else going on than just we don't want to freeze to death, so we're forced to be together. And you know, part of that is a bias that part of me wants to say even snake biologists, but I also want to say especially snake biologists have, that we just don't give them credit for a lot of things. We won't even consider certain behaviors. And I've actually gotten, not so much now because this has been going on for several years, but in the beginning, like more pushback from other herpetologists than from people that study birds or primates, that they just wouldn't even consider that there's anything going on besides we're cold and we have no choice but to be together. So that was where the project started. We wanted to see if there was a way, I'm not going to say through, but a way to show that there's something else going on besides just being cold. So what we did, we know from talking to a lot of people that observe snakes at dens that if you handle them too much, they change their behavior. Some people believe that they'll abandon the site, which obviously is not good for a study like this. Even if they don't abandon it, it seems like the snakes spend a lot less time on the surface, so it's hard to study behavior when you can't see them. So we had to find a different way to tell individuals apart for this study. So following work that's been done on, you know, people that study whales, people do all kinds of studies on whales, and nobody's catching them and putting pit tags in them. I mean, that's just ridiculous. So they use patterns. They use, in the case of whales, you use scars. And so what we did was Arizona black rattlesnakes, like a lot of rattlesnakes, have a series of blotches going down their back, which is usually visible. And those blotches, if you just glance at them, they seem pretty regular. But once you start looking for irregularities, they jump out. And with most snakes, we can pick out three or more irregularities and call that an identification. And so far, if we have at least three different things on a snake, we've never found another individual that has that exact same pattern. And of course, this sounds kind of circular because if I've already decided they're individuals and we never pick them up, how do we know? Well, when they're away from their den sites, we have been capturing them to get DNA samples for the genetics work. So we do have a backup with some of the snakes where we paint their rattles so then we can see who they are if we can't see the pattern. So that was the first step that was, for snakes, kind of a new and also a very old method of studying them. And then we used time-lapse cameras, remote cameras, that we set up so that we could monitor their behavior all day long and without having to worry about the presence of a human, even from a distance away with binoculars, disturbing their behavior. So that was really helpful because, as with all snake studies, we had zero money. People are expensive. Cameras are cheap, relatively cheap. So that was our basic setup. We had two springs where we collected data in 2011 and 2012. And at this site, snakes come out in the first or second week of April, and some of them hang out until mid-May. So we had about 4 or 5 weeks that we could collect data on snakes. And so then the next step is, like, that's great. We got all these pictures of snakes. We made time-lapse videos so we could see what they're doing all day. We know how to tell them apart. But how do you decide if they're social? We're still just at a pile of snakes. So again, because no one does this with snakes, or no one used to do this with snakes, now people are doing it. We went back to how people characterize sociality with other animals. And so we use what's called an association index. And basically that just estimates the amount of time any or every pair of animals in the population spends together. So if you have two snakes, Eve and Yellowtail, you take the number of times you see Eve by herself, the number of times you see Eve with Yellowtail, the number of times you see Yellowtail by herself, and also with other snakes that, you know, that aren't each other. And so that's the total amount of time you see those snakes. And then you, like, relative how many times just the two of them are together. And so that's the percent of their time that they spend together, or an estimate of, because obviously they're probably together and apart sometimes when we don't, when the cameras don't catch them. And that's their association index. And so it's a 0 to 1. 1, the snakes are together all the time. 0, the snakes are never together. And that's how we use, that was sort of the baseline that we started with to describe their social behavior. I feel like this is a very big, long speech.
No, not at all. It makes it easier to understand, actually.
Yeah, it's, and it's a little bit easier with some graphics. So I will go ahead and say on snakepreservation.org, there's a link at the top for our publications, and on that page there's a poster that we presented at Biology of the Pit Viper this summer, and it has like a graphical representation of how we calculated that, and also a lot of the other data I'm going to talk about tonight. It makes it a little bit easier than, yeah, than trying to explain it when you can see it. So those association indices kind of formed the basis for everything else we did. So the next step in describing this community of snakes and if there's any kind of structure going on is we did social network analysis, which is like Facebook. And it is actually kind of like Facebook. If you think about how Facebook works and how you have friends on there and how you find new friends through your current friends. So there's actually a plugin in Facebook where you can analyze your own network. I mean, that's just for nerds, but I did it. It's fun. So if you can picture like yourself, and you're a little node right here, and then you have a group of friends that's maybe like five direct connections that you have within the whole Facebook network, and then each of those friends has like five or six friends, and so thinking about it like the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon thing, so you're connected through so many connections. And so basically, we look at the whole community of snakes like that, and whoever associates with who, and who does and who doesn't. And you know, your default is, well, all the snakes use the same site. That's how we define a community. And you might expect, if they weren't making choices about who they do and don't associate with, that there would just be some average. So they're out. Each snake is out 3 days out of the whole sampling period, so that means they're not going to be associating with 100% of the other snakes, but there's some average calculation. So we figured out the average association index. From that, we were able to figure out if the snakes were spending more time than what we would expect with certain individuals. So if they're actually making choices. So if there's 10 snakes that use a site on a certain day, are all of those snakes out together? Or only some of those snakes out together? And we had to look at it on a day by day because there is a pattern to when they emerge from the den. So the pregnant and non-pregnant females and babies tend to come out first, especially the babies that come out first. They leave the den really fast, probably because a lot of them didn't have a chance to eat last summer before they went underground. So there's that pattern too that you have to take into account. But anyway, the short answer is that we did find that the snakes were actually making choices, that they did have some snakes that we call friends that they are associating with more than what you would expect if they were just random piles of snakes, and then there were other snakes that they avoided, and actually most pairs of snakes never associated at all, which was kind of surprising since they're all using the same place.
Really? So most of the quote-unquote mated pairs would never associate again?
Yeah, so if you look at, these are any pair. So it's any juvenile with any other juvenile, any female with any other female or male. It's just, if you can picture a matrix. So we had, at one of the sites, the simpler of the two sites, had 19 individuals. And so you have whatever 19 squared is divided by two possible pairs, because it's each one associating with each other. But most of those snakes never saw each other at all. So they would just have certain, so they actually had certain individuals that they picked. Some of it was probably due to environmental conditions. They like to be out on the same days. But again, even within a day, they have snakes that they choose to bask with and snakes that they choose to not bask with.
That is wild.
Yeah. The total nightmare. It's even harder to explain without having slides. It's the first time I've tried to do it without my slides.
And see, kids, why did you take math in high school?
No.
Oh my gosh. So they would actually pair. They actually showed a preference for one another. Versus just, well, we're presuming, of course, but it would seem that they've showed a social preference of, I like hanging out with this snake versus I like hanging out with that snake.
Yeah, I mean, statistically, which is, in science, the only way that we, you know, support or get rid of any idea that we have, I mean, statistically, yeah, they're making choices. They have preferred partners to hang out with, and they have other snakes that they avoid. And then we looked at those association indices, and there was a pretty big range. You know, for some snake, it was some pairs of snakes, they spent very little time together. You know, you'd see them once, and ended up being like 2% of their time. And then we had other animals that were together, you know, like 55% of their time. Or those are not real numbers. I am just taking them out of the air. But
yeah,
there was. It was a pretty big variation, and so with that, because we were interested in if are some of these bonds stronger, you know, people have theorized that a lot of the snakes that you see hanging out in the spring, that they might actually be mated pairs. Maybe those are males and females that get together later on. Maybe they're mothers with their offspring from previous years. So we wanted to see if there was some meaning to stronger bonds versus less stronger bonds. So we categorized by, we took the average of all those association indices, and if any given pair were together more than twice as much as the average, then friends. And we had friends that were female-female, female-juvenile, juvenile-juvenile, no male-male. Males and males will hang out with each other, but they're not very good friends.
So they'll hang out together, but they're not friendly with each other.
Yeah, not for like extended periods. Yeah, they don't hang out together for extended periods of time. You know, they don't 100% avoid other males, but we didn't see any bonds with them like we did with any of the other groups, which was interesting. Yeah. And at least as far as the nest that we've monitored, so trying to link it back to some of the work we've done on parental care at these sites, even though we did have females and babies that were from their nest, some of which are theirs, some of which are not, those explain very few of those friendship pairs too, which was interesting. So we have, so far, what those bonds mean. It was mostly double females.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's not a parental bond.
Yeah, it wasn't. It didn't seem to be a lot of parental bond. It could be, some of them could be like mother-daughter pairs from years before we worked there because they were older. They were adult snakes.
Sure.
You know, because we only started doing the family work a year before this. Summer before this, so we're still missing a lot of that, and maybe over the years we'll be able to fill in. That's kind of the problem with a study like this, because a lot of it was trying to figure out the best way to measure this, how do you characterize an association between snakes? I mean, we don't know what social behavior is in this context. You know, we know what fighting looks like with rattlesnakes. We know what mating and courtship looks like with rattlesnakes, but any other kind of social interaction, you know, we don't know. And probably a lot of it is through chemical cues, because that's important to a lot of snakes, mostly. So, you know, we used a very, you know, just a very basic rule of, are they within a body length of each other? So basically trying to capture, can these two snakes smell each other so that they have the ability to make a choice? And that was what we call an association. So it kind of opened up a lot more questions than answered, other than the very basic, you know, the thing I've been wanting to get at for 4 years, are snakes social? Yes, they are. Animal behavior, definition, they are social.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And especially last year when I had spoken to you originally, you know, we were talking and you had said, or at least had observed, what would appear to be a mother reining back in a hatchling from going too far away from the den.
Yes.
I remember you had caught that on film, and I was like, that's it. That is the epitome of, you know, social behavior. And you had actually said, well, we can't go that far yet because we still haven't finished the research yet. Do you think we can approach that now as far as saying that, yes, that was a social behavior versus an instinctual behavior?
Yeah, I think we can say, I can say a few more things about that. So the first thing is that I believe that example we talked about at that point, I think, was not actually that snake's mom, which was the other thing that actually made it so cool. It was a newborn, and the female that particular newborn hung out with all the time was still pregnant. And now that, so that was 2010, that was the first year we worked at this site, and Wow. Now we have three more nesting seasons that we've monitored them as well. So we've seen this behavior repeat with other snakes, and if there's more than one adult at a nest site, the snake that gives birth, once she gives birth, you don't see her anymore. She's there. She'll stay in the shelter because she has no reason to be out. I mean, they don't want to be out if they don't have to. Anyone who's ever been in the field looking for snakes knows this is the case. Even when the weather seems great, they're not out because for them, that's the most dangerous thing to do. So why? Unless you have to. That's why you don't find them. So spoiler alert, everybody.
Exactly.
So once they give birth, if there are other snakes around that can take care of their babies, they stay in shelter. So if there's still another female that's pregnant, they're just like, you take them. If there's a male hanging out at the nest site, which we've seen 4 or 5 times now, I think, every year there's been at least one male observed at one of our nests, then they'll leave the babies with him. If as long as there's somebody out there, To be a presence, think about dealing with, you know, even if they don't do any care behaviors like the one you were just talking about, you know, that's a form of, it is a form of care, because their presence is, you know, a lot more frightening than something like a squirrel, which is the most common attacker we see at our nest. So in that case, yeah, there was a baby. He had been hanging out a lot with this one pregnant female, and he started to wander out from underneath their shelter into the sun, and closer to the human observer, which, of course, from the snake's perspective, is the enemy, not the enemy, the threat. Mm-hmm. And she put her body in between that baby and the direction he was going into danger. And, you know, because we can't understand what they're saying to each other, it's hard to interpret with animals sometimes what is actually a signal. And so the way in animal behavior that we define signals, and the way you can call it a signal, is did the receiver respond in some way? And so in that case, and in other similar examples we've seen, that baby turned right around and went right back into the shelter. It was like the kid going and standing in the corner. That's what he looked like. And we've seen mothers do that too, and we've seen other cases where non-mothers have done that with babies as well. We've never seen a male do anything like that, but we see them sitting with the babies a lot. It seems like they're showing up at the nest sites to shed, and it could just be because it's a safe place for them. It's where they spend the winter or close to it. And for some of them, maybe it was where they were born, so they associate it with a safe place. And, you know, when snakes are shedding, they're kind of vulnerable because they can't see really well. But maybe it's just an aside, but the outcome is that they're there helping to take care of the babies, sitting out there with them, being a passive defense for whatever threat might come along. And that's been... Yeah, that was pretty surprising. We weren't expecting to see that. You know, we've never seen any of the males exhibit courtship behaviors to the females, so that's not what they're there for. And that would be a waste of time anyways, because the females are not interested in that the year they give birth. But they don't do it. Sometimes you'll get quick little, like, chin rubs, but we've seen that at the dens, too. And I think a lot of rattlesnakes do that, just to kind of say hi to each other.
That's what it would seem like to me is... The chin rubs is more of a acknowledgement signal. You know, hey, I know you're there. Mm-hmm. I don't want anything. I'm just letting you know I'm here so you don't try to eat me.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, if there is something with some of these sites and maybe they only certain, you know, friend snakes are allowed to use them, I mean, they communicate with chemicals. And when they do the chin rubbing, I mean, that's the purpose we think it plays in courtship, is that the male is saying, like, hey, I like you. So maybe they're also saying, like, hey, remember me? I'm Roger. I'm your cousin or whatever. I'm your friend, so I can hang out here. Because we've seen them. You'll see a snake approach a group of basking of snakes that are all hanging out, and the new snake will come up, and, you know, the other ones see the movement, and they look over that way. And then as the new snake is passing by, he'll do a quick chin rub on him. And right. And they usually respond. I mean, we've never seen one respond, like, aggressive. You know, usually they're just like, okay, cool, it's whoever, it's Ron, whatever.
Exactly. Oh, that's George, whatever. He's cool. Now, as far as the males, because we had talked about this before in the prior interview, males, according to species, I guess, don't exhibit too much parental behavior, even in the rattlesnakes.
Yeah, and that's, you know...
They're kind of a bunch of lazy bums. They just kind of hang out and be like, hey, yeah, I did my job, whatever.
Yeah, and there's some, I forget. I should know this stuff, but I've now been out of grad school too long. There's some evolutionary theory where you can predict how much parental care males should exhibit based on, like, their investment and, like, how often females give. And I forget. It had something to do with territory sharing. So you do see some stuff like that with some of the Australian skinks that have all the crazy cool social behaviors where they have, like, family groups that build tunnels together, like these crazy elaborate tunnel systems, and that stay in little rock piles their entire lives, and some of them mate for life and are actually behaviorally and genetically monogamous, which is really rare in any animal. Like, most birds cheat on each other. Everybody thinks birds are monogamous. They all cheat on each other. These skinks are one of the few that don't. Because evolutionary, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So with snakes, I mean, based on what we know about them and how their parental investment, you wouldn't predict that males would have a role to play there. So when we see them at the nest sites, you know, it could just be that they're there for other reasons, because they want to shed. You know, we're not sure. We haven't done radio telemetry at this site, so... At other places, the males, when they leave the dens in this species, they travel really far. So if that's what they were doing here, it would make no sense for them to come all the way back. And we're talking really far, like a mile or two, and these are not huge snakes. So that would be ridiculous for them to come this far back just to shed, but our males may not be doing that. Maybe they're hunting nearby anyway, and it's just a convenient spot. I don't want to make too much out of that until we start analyzing some of the DNA, and you know, I'm real interested in who are these males. We know that, the exception of one, they all share overwintering sites with the females whose nests they hang around. But we don't know if those are also the dads of any of these babies. You know, we don't know if the den site, you know, what most people assume is that since male rattlesnakes tend to search far and wide for females, that we think the way that they avoid inbreeding is that the males probably only mate with females from other dens. And if that's the case, they're not the dad of the babies at the nest site, but maybe they could be like uncle. They could be her brother or a son from a previous year. And so that is the kind of thing we're hoping to tease apart with the genetics. But it's just been slow going. It's hard to catch a lot of the snakes at this point. And we really want a more robust sample size before we start doing the blood work. We do have someone who's going to do it for us, which is cool. But we need more samples, but we have actually gotten a lot of the males now, which is promising.
Nice. Yeah, how do you, for our audience, how do you establish between instinctual behavior and social behavior? As far as research goes, is there, because we always hear about, eating is just an instinct. You know, you have to eat to survive. Or you have to breed to, continue the species. Is there a definitive way yet that science has come to conclusively and said, okay, this is instinct, this is, not instinct?
I think if people are trying to make that distinction between those two very broad groups of behavior, that's a false distinction because, so you can have innate and learned behavior, and innate just includes anything that you are, and we have innate behaviors too, that you're just programmed to do. Like animals just know how to do from the time they're born, and then you have things that you learn how to do that are taught. And so as far as learned behaviors in, well, reptiles in general, that is still a very new thing, and it's tough. It's a really tough thing to study because if we're talking about, you can learn by trial and error, so that doesn't require any kind of sociology at all. And you can imagine that for any predator, they get better at hunting. So do they innately know how to do some form of hunting from the time they're born? I'm sure every predatory animal knows how to do that. I don't think with any of them it's 100% learning, but they get better at it. And, with a lot of predators, that's through playing. That's why your cat likes to chase a ball around. It's not because they're into balls. It's because if they were in the wild and kittens, that's how they learn to kill things and chase things and hunt things down. That's why they're attracted to stuff that moves. And most predators learn how to hunt by playing. And with some, you've got mothers or dads to bring them back animals to play with.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyone has seen a house cat play, in that horrible way, but that is how they learn the proper way to kill something. The parent brings back something that's a not so dangerous prey so that when they do try to attack and kill and eat something that is dangerous, then they know how to do it. So as far as we know with rattlesnakes, no one has very clearly observed parents or any other snake teaching them how to do stuff like that, like hunting. There are some data to support a different type of social learning, and it is it's an indirect thing, and this is based on some work in the lab by Dr. Rulon Clark that I think you had on the podcast a long time ago as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, he also is definitely the complement to the other, like, suite of just very cool rattlesnake research. Like, his stuff is awesome. Yeah. So it was in the lab, but he had the snake set up in a very naturalistic enclosure. It was really big. And basically what he demonstrated, and this is a quick summary, if you had a rattlesnake in there, they let a prey item go. If that snake was successful at a certain spot in getting that animal and killing it and eating it, the next snake that came into that enclosure was more likely to use the same spot. And, you know, they did in such a way where it wasn't just like there was a really good spot. So they would shuffle it around and make that happen in different parts and different, you know, substrates and things in the enclosure. And this is something that a lot of animals that have social systems do, like insects do this a lot. And it can be through chemicals, so it's indirect. But a snake, it seems like, can assess a spot. Like, okay, this smells like successful hunting spot. So they know to use that. And that's why, you know, again, if you spend a lot of time in the field, and especially if you go back to the same places, you will see animals hunting in the same location. And sometimes we've seen different species of rattlesnakes using the same spots. So that may even be something that transfers from one species to another. It could just be a good spot, because that is not a controlled experiment we have done. But given what Dr. Clark demonstrated in the lab, it really makes you wonder. And it also makes you wonder if they are learning from each other about other good spots. So where is the best place to sit in sun where you can get warm, but you also have a little bit of shelter from aerial predators or you can't be seen as well? Like, can they transfer that sort of information too? And then this is basically it's the same kind of thing. So this is called public information. So it's not directed. It's not like the mother baby thing where the mom is directing the information at one individual. It's like the successful hunting snake sort of lays it down and it's open to anyone. So it's public.
Right.
Juvenile rattlesnakes, newborns, if they're not born right at their den, if they are born somewhere nearby, they will follow a scent trail from an adult back to the den, or we think that's what they're doing. It's a really hard thing to measure in the field. But that would be another example of public information. You know, somebody's leaving a trail. It might not be their mom. It might be just other rattlesnakes. It might not be intentional. But it is public information that's out there, and it's it's an indirect kind of social learning for them.
I have a question. When the baby snakes are born, and say they're born, you know, in the den, when they first travel out for their first real hunt, do they do it alone on their own time frame, or do we find, you know, groups of them going out at the same time?
That is a very good question. So the way it works generally, and there's some variation, you'll have a litter that's born. The parental care period lasts, the immediate parental care period lasts until they shed their skin for the first time, which is 7 to 14, you know, 1 to 2 weeks. And once the last baby has shed, so if one sheds a day or two early, they'll all stay together. But once the last one has shed, it appears that everyone splits up. Now, again, because they're so tiny, no one has placed radio transmitters on all these to see exactly what everyone's doing. And even the ones that are born right at the den, they split up, but they don't go very far. You know, if we hunt around right after the family split, we'll still find babies, like, hunting within, you know, like, most of them seem to be within a 20 to 50 yard radius from their nest site. And they are probably all in there. They're so hard to find because, you know, coiled up, they fit in the palm of my little hands. They're so cute. Sorry. I don't think they go very far.
Now, do they come back at any time after that? Besides when cold weather moves in, or, you know, for brumation period, do they come back and then travel back out?
That is a good question. They don't, at this site where we've done most of the work, they don't have a lot of time. They are finishing up, actually about this time of year is, in past years, is when the last families have split. And they can get snow, you know, second week of October. So they have maybe a month to hunt. So I don't know at night, until it's getting cold, they may just stay out all night hunting, although the babies are probably hunting lizards, so maybe not. I don't know. We haven't had cameras set up. Well, I take that back. When we've had time-lapse cameras set up after the family split, we haven't seen anyone coming and going during the day. So if they are doing that, they are exiting the shelter before the sun comes up and going back after the sun goes down, which probably means they're not doing it. They're probably just finding a spot near wherever they're hunting.
Oh, interesting. Now, do you find that the babies that are born, say, this year, do you find that they go back to the same den, or can you find those babies at other dens nearby?
We have not yet found any crossover between our den sites. So the site where we've been doing most of the work, there's one group of dens that's on one side of a road. There's two den sites there that are within 20 meters of each other and a bunch of places where the snakes bask and nest, about 10 sites all together. All of those, they share nest sites. Some of them nest in one den, some of them nest in the others. Across the street, and it's about 400 yards away, so not very far, is another den, and two nest sites associated with that one. And we've never seen anyone that's born on one side of the road show up on the other side of the road. Now, we haven't seen 100% of the babies at the den, so they could die. I'm sure a lot of them do die. Or maybe they're going to other dens, but we think we pick one up at that next closest den. 400 yards is not very far. I've had snakes go, three or four times that in a day, just, finding a new place to hunt. So if they were switching dens, it seems like we would have picked it up, but, absence, something is not evidence of absence, whatever that quote is.
Well, doing genetic work, you could actually kind of pinpoint a little bit better once you get the genetic work done between the den sites. Am I correct on that?
Yes. Yeah. And that's another thing, because we're also wondering if they are avoiding inbreeding, that would be a really nice, convenient place to pick up females too. So yeah, we are hoping with the genetics that we can clear up some of that.
Now, are they crossing the in between the den sites, are they crossing roads at all, or?
Again, because we have to create
or any type of man-made structure where they might encounter human predation, so to speak?
So between those two sites that I just described, there's a road and there's a trail, both of which, it's a dirt road, but both of them are very well used for dirt roads and trails. We've never found a snake on either one. We've never seen one on the trail. We've never seen one on the road. We've never seen a snake hit on the road. None of the other guys, there's a couple of people that know about the site, they've never seen it either. So I don't know if they just avoid crossing that, and that is why there's not any mixing from the dens that we know of. Again, like you said, once we do the genetics, we might find out that they are crossing a lot. We just don't see them. But that could be the barrier, or for whatever reason, we just don't find them. I'm not sure.
Okay, so it's basically like an, like almost island populations, like we had spoken of before, where there are specific populations divided by a certain landscape feature, if you will.
Yeah, these are, because it's a dirt road, I would be really surprised if it turns out that is a total genetic barrier. like you would see with, well, again, like Rulon Clark found that with timber rattlesnakes that he studied, that the presence of a road was a better predictor of how closely related snakes were between dens than the distance necessarily, or it helped. You know, you could have two dens that were closer together, but if there was a road going through them, the snakes were not as related as dens that were a little further apart, but there was no road in between. So it certainly has an impact on them. I think most of the roads in his study were more developed than ours, because it's like a two-track. Well, it used to not be a four-wheel drive road. Now it is, because they've gotten so much rain this year, which is good. But, well, sort of good. Most of the traffic on it is ATVs anyway, unfortunately. But, yeah, so it could be. But I would be surprised, just because they're so close, if it is functioning like island populations. But it could be.
Okay. Now, as far as the ATVs and human predation, for lack of a better term, do you guys see anything impacting your study sites as far as seasons are concerned with the ATV traffic and things of that nature?
You know, it's something I worry about constantly, but so far we have not seen anything at that site. It's scary. One of the snakes was gestating this year about 10 feet from the trail, which is the closest anyone has done. I don't know if she ended up giving birth yet, because it was Labor Day weekend. I don't go up there on Labor Day weekend because it's crazy. It's a really heavily used site for camping and especially hunting. And so once it gets close enough to hunting season here, where people are out scouting, you know, we stop going, because we don't want to draw attention to the sites. If people, you know, we're afraid that if people see us walking over there, like, what are they doing off the trail? Because no one walks off the trail here. Why would you do that? I think working in our favor is that people, at least at this place, are lazy, and they hardly ever get out of their vehicles or off their ATVs. I mean, even the hunters, like, when they shoot something off the road, they drive over and get it. Like, they don't walk over there. The people on the trails, they're mostly on horseback and mountain bikes. And so I think they're more watching where they're going or talking to each other than looking around. We had a snake in the hand one day taking blood and doing measurements, and a group of hikers like came around the corner. So, you know, we're all, oh, crap, and like hid behind a rock. But still, we were 50 feet away from them. They sat down and had lunch there. They never saw us. People just like, we just kind of, because they should be enjoying this. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful place. It's this gorgeous pine, and it's just lovely. But they don't look around, and I mean, it's a good thing in this case, because I think even though it is that close to trails and roads, no one ever wanders over there and has seen the snakes. Because I think if someone had, something bad would have happened to them, because it's not a hippie, like, animal-loving crowd, really, that's up there, I don't think. They don't come across that way.
They're more, give me a crowbar and I'll tear apart the den type people.
That's kind of what it seems like, yeah. Or at least they're going to shoot them.
Let's shoot them and post them on Facebook.
Yeah.
Well, of course. You got to do that.
So what are some of the aspects that you've run into with the preservation of rattlesnakes versus the population of snake haters because of your research?
Yeah, so my thoughts on how to go about snake preservation, snake conservation have been pretty solid for a while, and was actually a factor in me switching from the color project to social behavior. I think for a long time with reptiles, people who are interested in their conservation approached it from a numbers and from a utilitarian perspective. So they're like, well, you know, a snake eats a lot of mice, and mice eat crops, mice spread disease, so mice are bad. Snakes eat them, they're good, so we want to keep them around. And I think that message is appealing to some amount of people, But if you look at what conservation groups that are interested in other animals do, no one ever talks about the impact of whales on plankton and whatever else they eat. You know, you never hear, like, we need to save whales because they eat a lot of plankton. Even with sharks, like, the shark people the last couple years have been doing a really good job with promoting sharks. But you hardly ever hear, like, we need sharks because we would be overrun with fish. The way that we overfish, like, that's not going to happen anyway. But, yeah. You know, they never say that. They in the case of sharks, they talk about how cool they are. With whales or with chimps, you know, they talk about how they have families and they take care of their kids. And they pick on these behaviors that people like. They're things that we can relate to. We're social animals. We have families. We place a high importance on other humans that take care of their kids. And we do that with animals, too. That's something that we find very appealing. So what I decided to do a few years ago when I started blogging at Social Snakes was, why can't we make an emotional appeal for snake conservation? I realize that it's not something that's traditionally thought of as cute, and whatever, you guys are wrong. They are so cute. But, you know, why not? And I got laughed at, especially by my graduate advisor. He was just like, there's no way. No one is going to think a rattlesnake is cute. But I have seen people change their mind. You know, at the beginning of a talk, when I, you know, I ask people what they think, and, you know, by the time I get to the end and I showed them videos of mommy rattlesnakes taking care of their babies, defending them from squirrels, to hear a group of not snake people cheering on a rattlesnake over a squirrel is amazing, because most people love squirrels. They're little, they're furry, you know, they're adorable, but, and people don't generally like rattlesnakes. But when they see a video of a squirrel going after a bunch of baby rattlesnakes that I have been, like, pumping up at that point, talking about their families, like, it's really interesting to see that change, and it's really cool. And I had people come up to me afterwards and say, you know, this has totally changed my mind. Like, I don't think I could just whack that diamondback in my backyard's head off anymore. Even though it's a different species, it's a different situation, but now when they look at snakes, instead of the first thing that pops in their mind being evil, sinister, and sneaky, they think babies and families and social groups, and, you know, at least it gives them some other things to think of instead of just the way that they're usually portrayed in movies and myths and stories. And, you know, even on documentaries, even the old documentaries that we now think of as good, before there were the crap that's on now, they still usually, when they show, you know, you show a rattlesnake, you show them coiled up and rattling. I mean, a lot of us, when we put pictures up, we like them. We throw up a picture of a rattlesnake rattling because it's very dramatic. But when that's the first thing that pops into the public's mind, they don't think that's cool and beautiful. They think that is a mean animal that is waiting out there in the desert to attack them. And so I don't do that. It's like one of the little subtle things. I never post pictures anywhere of snakes behaving defensively. I use one picture like that in my talk to explain this to people. Like, this is what you usually see. This is what that actual individual looked like before I pulled him out from under the bush and, you know, threatened his life in his mind. But yeah, because it seems like such a tiny thing, and it actually makes a huge difference with people.
And how are you doing outreach to the public as far as the Association for Snake Preservation?
Yeah, so we have a couple different venues. Of course, we have a Facebook page with a very nice, like, very engaged community. It's wonderful. People share our stuff. They love to have conversations in the comments, which are maybe surprisingly to anyone else who also runs Facebook pages, they're not all bad. sometimes they're actually quite nice. And we're getting a pretty strong following on Twitter as well. With people sharing and having conversations that way. And so that's nice because we can reach a much bigger audience that way. I don't think it has the same impact as, you know, in-person stuff does. So we still do outreach presentations around Tucson, Arizona, which is where two of the founders of ASP live. And then our third person is in the Bay Area of California, so we're now able to do presentations there as well, where we show videos of some of these behaviors I've been talking about, and talk about some of the threats that snakes face, and, you know, how we are, you know, battling a lot of that with education, but we're starting to get into some advocacy-type things, too, and campaigns, most of which, unfortunately, I can't talk about yet, but hopefully we'll be able to discuss publicly soon. And then, you know, depending on the venue, I have some live animals, some live snakes that I bring out as ambassadors for their species. So that really helps, especially with kids. It's one thing to talk about snakes not being aggressive, but, you know, even when they just see one of my juvenile rattlesnakes sitting in a cage, but he's just sitting there, not trying to strike anyone, he's not in that defensive posture, it's really hard to get him to rattle. That makes an impact, but getting to hold a friendly gopher snake makes a huge impact on a lot of people, too. And eventually, and I think we finally found a place to do that, around Tucson, we're going to start taking people out on snake hikes so they can see some not scary snakes in the field as well. There's a B&B near Tucson that has a very healthy population of diamondbacks, and they're doing what I wish everyone did with rattlesnakes in their yard. They're not herp people. They're just really into nature in general, and they decided a long time ago that instead of moving their snakes or killing them, they named them. They figured out who was who, and they just took the time to observe where the snakes like to hang out, and they know every place in the area, like right around their house, where the public goes, because it's the B&B, so they have public in and out of there all the time, and when you arrive, they walk you around, and they show you every bush and every bird feeder that the snakes like to hunt at, and that way they just know to exercise extra caution in those areas. And because of that, they have known individuals with known habits that show up at their place, and it's pretty rare for them, they told me, to see a snake in a new place. So they just know when you're walking on this part of the path, you need to be careful. Over here, you can spend a little more time looking up at the trees to find birds. And that's something that I'd always thought would work. Really interesting to see it in practice, and it was really cool. And to see it from someone who's not, you know, a herpetologist, somebody you would expect to do that. We just decided that was a better way, a safer way for them. And it has been. They've never had an incident. And one of their students named Cartman, and he's awesome.
And you've done that a lot with dealing with outside of the scientific community. You found a lot of support for your research and things of that nature, where not necessarily herpetologists, but people that are out in the field have relayed to you den sites and things of that nature, where they're like saying, hey, you know, you might want to check out this den site versus this other one, as far as places to research and things of that nature, have you not?
Yeah, I have had a couple of people approach us about that, and some members of the public who are just interested. There's a guy local in southern Arizona that finds diamondback rattlesnakes on his property, and he wants to build them an artificial den in his yard, and he reached out to us about helping with that, and I'm not sure if we'll be able to do it this winter, but we might help them put together something like that, and then also help them monitor it, because we have, you know, we bought 15 cameras to do the social behavior study, and they're just like hanging out in the house now. Well, that's not true. Two of them are in Belize, but most of them are just hanging out in the house, and so it would be great to do more stuff like that. And I'm also collaborating with a group that's had a long-term study of western diamondback rattlesnakes, and they do radio telemetry, so it's a very different type of data, but we're actually trying to apply some of the social network analysis to looking at the structure of that population, which appears to be so far very, very different from what Arizona black rattlesnakes do.
Okay.
Interesting. I have a question, Melissa, and it comes with telemetry and that whole thing. Earlier in the show, you had mentioned that due to humans coming to den sites, we've had actually witnessed snakes leaving the site and abandoning the site at one time when they were handled at the site. So I'm guessing that when the telemetry part may come into play for your study, are you going to start capturing them away from the site to stick with that? Or you know, how does that play into to role on getting the transmitters actually on the snakes?
Yep. That is the main reason why we have not done telemetry at that site. Actually, there's a couple things. So, yeah, I don't think we will ever do telemetry up there, and that's part of the reason because, yeah, and the results are mixed. I've had lots of snakes that we've had radio transmitters in at other places that have come back to the same place where we caught them and put the transmitter in them. So I don't think that rule is 100%. It does seem like the snakes might be a little more sensitive about special spots like nest sites and den sites, but there hasn't been a study of this. You know, these are anecdotal things that people have noticed, and if you don't have radio transmitters in them, and if you're not seeing the snake anymore, you can assume that that's why. It could have died. It could just be hiding under a rock. You know, they could change their behavior, and you don't know. We decided to play it on the safe side and never touch them at these sites. And so for collecting the DNA for the genetics, you know, that's why we haven't done it yet, because we waited until they're on the move and away from the site. So we're very much limited with just having to come upon them as they're leaving the site in the spring, or with the family situation, you know, after they've started hunting and stuff. And then we catch them and take blood and measure them and stuff. But yeah, that's why we've only gotten half or a little less of all the snakes in the study. It's a lot harder that way. It's tempting to catch them while just hanging out at a den because they're all right there. But a lot of the den sites where people have done that, the snakes don't behave in the same way that they do at our site. There could be other factors, but the safest thing to do, we decided, was just, you know, not do that. We're more interested in the behavior than the genetics, at least to start. You know, you can always do, and this was kind of always our plan, do the behavior first, touch them never at those sites, touch them as little as possible elsewhere, and then once we've gotten enough behavioral data to do what we did, you know, then we can go back and try to catch them. And yeah, some of the snakes have died, so we're not going to get everybody that was part of the initial study, but hopefully we'll be able to get enough, whereas if we had started catching them initially, we might not have gotten any behavioral data or enough genetics, and I would still be in grad school, and that's just the worst possible outcome.
Right. Now, do you think, in your personal opinion, would it be easier to put the transmitters in babies and juveniles that kind of might still be learning a behavior or finding those special sweet spots that you had mentioned earlier? Do you think it would be easier just to kind of, you know, look at the transmitters for the younger ones versus, you know, an older one and an adult that's been around and you know, that might be afraid of doing that site?
Yeah, that's interesting. No one's, and a lot of this is because no one's really made that comparison if it has less of an impact on a young animal than it does an old one. And part of the reason for that is the batteries on transmitters that are small, transmitters that are small enough to put on juvenile snakes. So with snakes, for those who don't know, you have to implant them inside of the body. You know, they can't wear a collar because, snakes. And if you tape them on, which you can do taping or gluing, but as soon as they shed their skin, the transmitter is gone. So it's a much shorter term project doing it that way. So most radio telemetry studies with snakes, you do a surgery and you put it inside the body cavity. So because of that, it has to be really small. And the smaller a transmitter is, the smaller battery, the less range, so the closer you have to be able to pick up the animal, but also the less time it's going to last. So The smallest transmitters I worked with, which were still would be too big for a newborn, but you could look at putting in a rattlesnake that's a year or two old, they would last 6 months. And so then you're looking at doing really frequent surgeries, very difficult to get animals through the winter without timing it just right. And, you know, going under anesthesia that often, like, we have no idea what kind of impact that has on an animal. I mean, if you've ever had a procedure done to yourself where you had to go under anesthesia, like, it's a big deal. We have human doctors that do that, especially, you know, with our older, like, dogs and cats, you have to get blood work done and all this stuff to make sure you're okay. And so to just be doing that, never mind the, like, cutting them open and stuff to put it in, it's a big impact. So there hasn't been a lot of work of any kind done with juvenile rattlesnakes, but that's an interesting idea that it might affect them less. And dens aside, the most common way that we encounter a rattlesnake or any snake is when they're out on the move, right? Because they're a lot easier to spot when they're out crawling. And they know that is the most dangerous thing they do already. So that's the best time to catch them and do this bad stuff to them, because they already know, like, oh, I knew I had this risk, and now, it happened.
Right.
So that's the best thing to do, but then, you know, you're lucking into catching one, and so, you know, you might get one that's associated with a den like this, you might not. And we did luck into at Mule Shoe, the dens that we had there, we found all of them because snakes that we put transmitters in when they were middle of summer, like, crawling around, then led us back to dens that they shared with other snakes. So it can happen that way. But it's a lot easier when you just have somebody that shows the den to you.
Right. Chad, you have anything? I think I'm pretty good. I mean, I've been just sucked into the whole conversation this whole time.
I know, me too. It happens every single time she's on the show.
So, nothing. I do want to, because there's a chat going on between us about DNA from, like, how do we get DNA? Because I keep talking about the limitation with that is that we had to catch the snakes and we didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
And so Chad asked to get it from shed skins. And you absolutely can get DNA from sheds. And that's great when you can do that because you don't have to handle the snakes at all. And if the shed is fresh enough, on Arizona black rattlesnakes, because they have so much dark pigment in their skin, you can often see the pattern. So those same irregularities that we use to identify the snakes, sometimes we can pick that up in the shed too. So it does need to be fairly fresh. DNA degrades rather quickly in sunlight. Most of the rattlesnakes at our site tend to shed in their shelters anyway, so the sun isn't the problem. But because they shed in their shelters, often we just don't find them. So we had great hopes of, you know, again, like, the families are together until the babies shed and then they split. And they keep talking about how the males come there to shed and then, you know, they leave. But it seems like when they shed their skin, they go way deep into these dens and nest sites. And sometimes we can see the sheds and pull them out, but most of the time we can't. But we have gotten some that way. And when I said we'd only gotten DNA from a little less than half, that's actually not counting the sheds, because we haven't done a really great inventory of the sheds we've gotten. And we do have, especially with the babies, we've gotten a lot of sheds.
That was
a good question.
Is it the squirrels interacting with the Arizona black rattlesnakes that rub the shed skins on the fur of the squirrels? I've seen a couple of videos of the squirrels going up and grabbing a shed skin and, like, rubbing themselves down with it. So if you wouldn't mind that.
That is... No, maybe that's where we'll find the shed. I'll blame the squirrels for that one, too. The videos you've seen, those are western rattlesnakes, like northern Pacifics and southern Pacific rattlesnakes. So the best studied squirrel rattlesnake interactions are from California. So that's where those, I think, probably, I've never seen a video of any other species. And we've never seen a squirrel doing that, but, I mean, you know, we don't follow squirrels around all the time, so they might. But yeah, and that, they're not, DNA, people think that they're like making themselves smell like a snake, so the snakes have a more difficult time detecting them, but I'm not sure that we know exactly what the deal is with the rubbing snake skins on you. It's weird. That is a question for Rulon Clark.
Okay, fair enough. And what about obtaining DNA from venom? Is that something you guys can... I mean, obviously you can do that. Is that something you folks are looking into later on?
No. we have no interest in collecting venom from snakes. Because, you know, every type of thing that we need to do to a snake, we can do with the snake in a tube. You know, we can use tongs, we can put the head in a tube, which, for those who don't know, this is just a clear plastic. It looks like a big straw that you can see through, and it's a way to safely kill a venomous... I guess it works best with vipers. But when you're extracting venom, you have to deal with a head that's not in a tube, and I have no interest in doing that. So, yes, you can get DNA from venom, but while that just seems like a dangerous and kind of an invasive way, too. I mean, some snakes, I know I had a friend who was looking at venom in Mojaves, and he could, like, put them through a big tube, and when the head shot out the opposite end, they would just bite whatever you put up there. I'm guessing Arizona black rattlesnakes, it would be a lot harder because they're so timid. I could see them just, not all of them, but some of them, I don't think they would bite. I think you would have to, like, you know, you can head pin him and, like, manually get the venom out. I think that's probably what we have to do. And I'm not interested in doing that kind of stuff with the snakes. There's so many cool questions where I don't have to handle them that much or at all that we will be doing that forever, I think.
Yeah, I agree with you on extracting venom. They can keep it all to themselves.
I don't have venom.
I have one last question. Do you ever plan on going back and looking at color change?
I was going to ask that question.
I'm interested in the whole color change thing.
Yeah, I know you are.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing that they do. So someday, and yeah, I mean, maybe after we get the social stuff published, we have a lot of data. We have a lot of data that we never analyzed. The real stopping point was we were trying to do some experiments in the lab, which mostly were just we had in containers that we heated up and cooled down to see if that would make them change color, and it didn't. But what we do have is a lot of photographs that can be color corrected, so we can look at, you know, the situation they were in, the time of year, the substrate background, and see if there's any correlations with anything there. So we have a lot of those data that we have not looked at. And when we started doing radio telemetry at Muleshoe, we took a lot of color measurements with those animals. So we have a lot of repeated on the same individuals, which we didn't have before. So maybe... maybe nothing will come out of that, but we'll see. Because it is interesting, and it's still, like, whenever I hear one of the myths of why they do it, it's still just like, oh, that's not true, but I don't have, like, data. Darn it. Frustrating.
So nobody behind you has picked it up and wanted to kind of follow suit with that?
No, and I, you know, I would be cool, and I would be willing to, like, tell somebody what we tried and, like, what little we found, but I think that kind of talks a lot of people out of it. So, like, yeah, nope, we tried heating up. Nope, it's not seasonal. Nope, they're not gray at night and black during the day. They do it both, like, just everything. The only, and this is just an observation, not statistics, but they seem to change color more readily during the breeding season than the rest of the year, which is interesting, and I don't know why that would be, unless it's a signaling thing like it is with chameleons, which you wouldn't expect from an animal that's not supposed to have good color vision, but I don't know. That was something we saw.
I wonder if it has to do with emotions.
Yeah, if someone has asked about that before, and that is certainly the case with some lizards, like tree lizards will, and with a lot of lizards that fight, you know, there's the aggressive color, which is usually a dark color, so that's how you know if they want to fight or if they don't want to fight. So it could be, and that was one of the things that I was proposing to do, which my advisors were like, that will not work. I wanted to fight snakes. And see, and also look at female choice, and if the female, you know, like maybe this, since it, we did see this like more color change during the mating seasons, we thought, well, maybe it has to do with combat, and maybe they turn different colors when they're fighting to signal that they don't want to fight anymore or to avoid a fight. And, you know, maybe females are attracted to darker snakes or lighter snakes. And I've also heard people say that the males are making choices based on color, but I don't know. I don't know about that. These are not people who have done experiments. So, yeah, it could be. But apparently it's very hard to get snakes to fight in captivity. One of my advisors, Gordon Stewart, that his PhD was all about copperhead combat. He did a lot of stuff on copperhead combat and mate choice, and he said it was really difficult, and he really didn't want to send me down that path because it was hard to get them to fight. And the female choice thing, he's like, they will almost definitely not do that in a cage.
Really? So they will alter their behaviors once they get into a captive environment then?
Yeah, and, you know, maybe it would be different if you had captive-bred snakes, or, if you could somehow remove the stress of, I don't know. I don't know how many different things he tried, how those snakes were kept, yeah. How naturalistic exposure was. I don't know, but he said, yeah, that they... And it could just be that there's not a lot of mate choice going on in the wild. I mean, we make assumptions about snakes that are in combat, and, you know, the whole story is, like, oh, the bigger male, like, defeats the other one by pushing him to the ground, and then the female's going to go with that one over the other one. But I, you know, how often that's actually been recorded, I don't think very. It's a nice story, though.
It's not like there's a bunch of females standing on the sideline like cheerleaders. I get the winner. I get the winner. I mean.
Yeah, that's something that's always fascinating.
I don't care at all.
That's always fascinating me, actually, is when the males combat, it's like there, generally speaking, is no female around.
Well, I think mostly there is. They're usually hidden somewhere.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because I've seen, like, you know, there was a pair of snakes at Muleshoe that I've got some, not Arizona blacks, because I've never seen them fighting, the one thing. But a pair of diamondbacks that these two boys, they shared a den, and it's some times of the year. Actually, so there was one week they were hanging out at this particular spot, the manure pile. They were coiled up within, I don't know, 3 or 4 feet of each other, so pretty close. I'm sure they knew the other one was there. A week later, same spot, I filmed them fighting for like a half hour. I never saw the female, but I assume there was one there because I don't know why else they would do that. I mean, as far as we know, they don't defend territory because you see snakes like that in close proximity or close enough or crawling next to each other during the active season. And if you look at, like, you know, people that have radio tracked them, their home ranges overlap all over the place. It's not like big cats or something. So we think that they are usually fighting over females. But, you know, if the female's not into it, they will probably still fight. So they start fighting, and she could just take off. Yeah, it's like, you big dummies. You can go eat. Leave me alone.
That's males for you. Males, they're just wrestling around. They're just playing games.
Exactly.
Wasting time.
Just wasting time. Have you ever heard about blue racers chasing people in the field?
I have heard a lot of stories about a lot of different snakes chasing.
Well, what I heard is... I guess they don't have very good eyesight. And up here, people wear blue jeans in the field, And these snakes will come up and see them and chase after them and think they're another snake because they got bad eyesight. And I guess that's why they chase people out of the fields around here. Because I'm in farm country and we got a ton of blue racers around here.
Well, that's really interesting. No, I've never heard that as a potential explanation of the chasing. I think usually when people say that they're being chased by snakes, they're full of it. You know, there's like something behind them that the snake wants to get to and hide, and so they think they're chasing, and really he's just trying to get to that rock. But I from legit sources, I know that some elapids do chase people. And because in so many ways, colubrid racers seem like, I don't know. I can almost believe that. I'm surprised that they wouldn't be able to smell the difference. But maybe if it's like that time of year and their hormones are so raging, like they don't take the time to be like, wait a minute, that smells like a person, not a snake.
And I can attest to that in captivity. Males in captivity, I mean, during the springtime, take them out. I have 4 or 5 males that will actually crawl up my arm and, you know, try mating with my finger. I mean, they don't care. They just, and I'll go in and I'll wash my hands and make sure I have no female smell on my hands. And it's just that. Pick them up, boom. Latch onto my arm and wrap me around and tails will start flapping. But, you know, so males, yeah, sometimes they don't care.
All right. Well, I have seen a lot of pictures of rattlesnakes courting roadkill females. So, yeah, I guess that's the, yeah, they're just not thinking straight.
Typical male, blind passing. Unrequited.
We got a spotted turtle at the nature center and breed the rock.
Yeah, well, I mean, turtles aren't as smart as snakes.
Come on. Hey, now.
Everybody knows snakes are smarter than turtles. Come on.
Come on.
So what are we looking forward to as far as your research, Melissa, in the near future?
Yeah, so hopefully we'll have a big enough size to run the genetic stuff and to see, well, I guess the first thing, hopefully we'll have a paper in a peer-reviewed journal about social behavior at the dens to be followed by something looking at how genetics may, how relatedness may or may not explain those social relationships. And there's definitely a couple of things I'm working on with the guys that studying Western Diamondbacks and different aspects of their social behavior that'll be coming out. Actually, some of that's going to be coming out in the Rattlesnakes of Arizona book that's supposed to be released next year. I think it's next year. There's a couple, it's going to have species accounts, and we wrote the one for Arizona Blacks. There's not going to be a ton of new stuff in there. I mean, some. But in the beginning of that book, they're having sections on, you know, like conservation, and there's also one just on social behavior. So some of the stuff that may not get published elsewhere first will be in that. Some of the Diamondback stuff is probably going to be in that unless the book slows down and we speed up on the peer review stuff.
Right. Now, as far as your research and its continuance, over at the snakepreservation.org/research, there is a donate button down at the bottom left-hand side. And one of the things I want to make apparent to our audience, in case they aren't aware of this, is we always hear about the government research grants and what have you going to such things as how long can a cockroach survive on chocolate bars and things of that nature. This is one of those studies where we can actually donate directly to the studies. They take the donation research money, go and buy cameras and buy genetic supplies, and you actually are funding essentially your own research, as it were, because of the government hullabaloo. Science is really hard-pressed to get any grants or any money whatsoever to research anything. If you could talk to us a little bit about where our donations would go and things of that nature.
Yeah. So we are working on getting 501c3 public charity status with the IRS for Advocates for Snake Preservation. We have turned in our application so that we should have that back very soon. And the way that process works is once you're approved, any money that you've taken in since you named the group and became incorporated, which we did in April, is tax deductible. So if you're in the U.S. and you itemize donations, any money you give to us, number one, is a write-off, because I see no reason why we wouldn't get that public charity status. I mean, we're not a political group. We're political people, but we're not a political group, and, you know, it seems pretty cut and dry. We're obviously not making any money at this. So what Advocates does, so we're expanding a little bit from the social snake stuff, which is strictly education, and we're using education and science and advocacy to fight snake conservation issues, or not to fight the issues, to fight the threats to snake conservation. So we're continuing with a lot of this natural history and behavior research that is interesting because it's new. It's something that a lot of scientists don't pay attention to. But it's also really useful for the education that we do. Like we've been talking about, people really like this. And so we're trying to change the way people view and treat snakes. It makes it really hard to do conservation on even a snake like the San Francisco garter snake, which is just gorgeous and wouldn't hurt anybody. But because it's a snake, and they carry with them all this cultural baggage that we've given to them of being evil and garden of Eden and all that stuff, you know, it's hard to get public support for that, let alone something that's potentially dangerous like a rattlesnake. So we're trying to get people to think of snakes in a new light, and so that is a big chunk of what we do. Kind of two-thirds of what we do is dedicated towards gathering information to then educate the public and brainwash them. And then the other third, the advocacy and campaigning stuff, we're looking at some issues that are not going to be solved strictly by education. So things like rattlesnake roundups, and so we're in talks with Rise Against Rattlesnake Roundups, as well as some other people, about different ways to tackle that, to get those to change. We're not looking to end rattlesnake roundups. We're looking to get them to change their festivals to be education or science research-based. So there's a great example in Georgia of one that's been turned into a no-kill wildlife education festival that's bringing in more money and attracting more people than the old Torture and Kill Fest ever did. And I also understand that in Pennsylvania, the rattlesnake roundups that they have there, they do collect animals from the wild, but it kind of has a research spin on it where they bring them in and they do the stuff that most scientists would do. You know, they measure them, they mark them, they take them back to where they originally caught them. And so both of those models would be a big improvement. They still attract tourists. They still, you know, people still pay money to get in. People are fascinated by snakes, and that is the main driver for those events. I don't think it's the torture and the killing. I think it's just because they're snakes, and people are interested even if they're scared of them. And so we would like to work toward all the roundups being changed to one of those models or some sort of combination of both of them. And so we're just trying to figure out the best way to go about that, and that's a big project that we will be working on probably for a long time. So yeah, any donations we get goes directly to that. There are three of us that work at Advocates. As we expand, we're going to have to add on a bigger board of directors, but those will always be, well, the board of directors will always be volunteers. I'm sure we're way down the road from having paid staff, so the money goes directly into the work we do with snakes, and, you know, we have some administrative stuff, although that mostly has come out of our own pockets so far. So that's what you're going to do, and hopefully another month, if I don't sell them all at the Tucson Reptile Show, we'll have some t-shirts to buy, and proceeds from that will go to help snake conservation and feed hungry people, because we're going with this hippie clothing shop in Tucson that feeds hungry people when you buy clothes from them.
That works.
Kill two birds with one stone.
Well, no, that's a sad way of putting it, but yeah.
Oh, boy. Anything else, guys? Chad, any more questions? Because I think we should wrap this one up. And very interesting interview, Melissa. Glad to have you on. I was definitely intrigued the whole almost 2 hours here.
Very cool stuff. Yeah. It definitely has progressed a lot more since last time we talked a number of years ago. Man, that's just awesome stuff.
For our audience, and please take and check out snakepreservation.org. Make sure you donate while you're there. Check it out. Also, socialsnakes.org. Is that correct too, Melissa? Is still up and running as well?
Yep, that's still where we do all our blogging at socialsnakes.org.
So check out those two. Anything else you want to promote?
Oh boy, I think that's it. Thank you guys so much for having me. It was great. It was really interesting. Good questions.
Thanks for being on.
Awesome to have you back, Melissa, definitely.
All right, audience, this is our last Thursday night show, so starting either the first Tuesday in October or September 30th, one of those 2 days, we will be switching till Tuesdays. So no longer any Thursdays. You'll be able to catch us on Tuesdays at 9 p.m. till 11 p.m. on G+, Facebook. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/reptileliveroom. Anyway, everybody have a good weekend, and we will see you next time.
Awesome. Thanks again, guys.